TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. David Quammen, Shaking the Viral Tree. An interview by Emmanuel Vaughn Lee. In his 2012 book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, the science writer David Quammen predicted another coronavirus outbreak. At the end of March 2020, the editor of Emergence magazine, Emmanuel Vaughn Lee, talked with Quammen, who was sheltering in place in his Bozeman, Montana home. I'm very grateful for Emmanuel Vaughn Lee's permission to bring you as much of his interview as fits into this 29-minute time slot of TUC Radio. And I'm leaving in place his carefully phrased introduction to the conversation that was first broadcast on March 25, 2020. He is the filmmaker, musician, and executive editor of Emergence magazine, Emmanuel Vaughn Lee.
Earlier this week, I spoke with science writer and journalist David Quammen, whose many books include Spillover, Animal Infections, and the Next Human Pandemic. We spoke about the root causes behind the current pandemic and the ways in which viruses are embedded in the same systems of ecology and evolutionary biology that we are. Against the backdrop of our ongoing disruption of wild ecosystems that shake these viruses free, the novel COVID-19 virus offers an opportunity to rethink and reimagine our relationship with the natural world. David, thank you very much for joining us this morning. The coronavirus is what is known as a zoonotic virus. Could you start off by explaining what a zoonotic virus is and how it ended up infecting humans in a market in Wuhan, China?
Yes. A zoonosis is an animal infection that's transmissible to humans. And that can be a virus or a bacterium or any other sort of infectious bug. But a zoonotic virus is one that comes out of a non-human animal and somehow passes into humans. And if it takes hold and can replicate and cause disease and transmit, then we call that a zoonotic disease. And 60-70% of our infectious diseases fall into that category. Some of the old plagues and some new plagues like this one. How does it happen? Well, all animals carry, including wild animals, carry their own, in some cases, unique viruses, great diversity of viruses. We don't have any idea really how many viruses are out there, but animals, plants, fungi, all those cellular creatures carry viruses. Viruses are not cellular. They're just little capsules containing genetic information that can replicate themselves in the cells of other creatures. When a virus passes from a non-human animal into a human, we call that moment spillover, hence the title of my book. And the animal from which it comes, in which it the virus lives sort of inconspicuously, we call that the reservoir host or the natural host, but I usually call it the reservoir host. So you've got a reservoir host in China, probably a horseshoe bat. It's carrying a coronavirus that has never been seen in humans before. That bat is captured probably live and put in a cage and taken to a wet market in the city of Wuhan, China. I think we know that that was the Wuhan wholesale seafood market, but it was selling much more than seafood. I've been in some of these markets and I've seen they sell wild animals, they sell domestic animals, they sell seafood. There are live animals in cages, sometimes stacked on one another, all kinds of wild birds as well as domestic poultry. There are reptiles, turtles, sometimes snakes, bats, pangolins, civets, pigs, all a great mixing bowl. And what seems to have happened in Wuhan, we don't know for sure, but what seems to have happened is that a virus from a horseshoe bat spilled over into probably some other kind of an animal, got amplified in that animal, and then that animal was sold, was butchered, somehow infected maybe a few dozen people. And those people became the sort of the primary contact cases. And then from them, it found itself with the ability to spread from one human to another and spread out into the community of Wuhan. This was all going on in December of last year. And on New Year's Eve, the alarm bells rang at the WHO, the CDC, and elsewhere for some friends that I know in the scientific world. And the word was there was a new disease, an infectious disease spreading in Wuhan, China, suspected to be a virus. The virus is not yet known. The origin was not yet known, but it could be a big one. That was New Year's Eve, and we have seen it unfold from there.
Mm. And as far as I understand, the virus was actually detected in a cave in Yunnan, 1,000 miles from Wuhan. You've written about this.
That's right. Why
wasn't something done about it?
When scientists spot a new virus and there's reason to suspect that it could be dangerous, then they publish that and they alert people to that. And that happened. In 2000, I think the virus was detected maybe in 2015, 2017, the scientists published a paper saying, here's a new coronavirus. We found it in horseshoe bats in a cave in Yunnan. It could be dangerous. It's not identical to the original SARS coronavirus from 2003. It's distinct from that. But it has characteristics judging from its genome and judging from the fact that it is a coronavirus, it could be dangerous. So the scientists did their job. They published that paper. What happens then? Well, essentially nothing happens then. What should happen? Well, there should be a system for people responding to that threat. There should be closures of the wild animal markets in China. There should be preparedness around the world. There should be a readiness to take the genome of that virus and turn it into test kits quickly, produced en masse, available around the world. That's all expensive stuff for something that might happen and might not happen. And because it's expensive and it might not happen, policy makers, leaders, legislators are reluctant to pay for it.
Right. And once a virus leaves its reservoir host, as far as I can understand, it can mutate and mutate quickly.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about this?
That's right. And that's especially true of coronaviruses and several other groups of viruses. Some viruses evolve much more quickly than others. Some people don't even know, you know, a virus, is it alive or not? Well, that's a philosophical and semantic discussion. But does it evolve? Yes. It replicates itself. It carries either DNA or RNA and replicates itself using the same genetic code that the rest of the world uses. So in that sense, it's closely connected to life if it's not alive, and viruses evolve. But some viruses evolve much more quickly than others, and the reason for that is differences in their genomes. Some viruses carry a genome composed of the DNA double helix molecule that everybody knows about, which replicates itself rather accurately and stably. And when it makes a mistake with the letters of the genetic code in replicating itself, there is a proofreading mechanism so it can correct itself. So double-strand DNA, double helix viruses tend not to evolve very quickly. There are several other different kinds, one of which is a single-stranded RNA virus. RNA is another genetic molecule, closely related to DNA, but a little bit different. And a single strand of it, when it replicates itself, tends to make a lot of mistakes. And those mistakes are not corrected. So as a virus replicates, it is producing imperfect copies of itself. It's producing a population of variant offspring that differ from one another. So you've got a population of variant individual virus particles inside a host, and they're competing with one another for resources, for the opportunity to replicate further. And what do you have when you have a population of variant individuals competing with one another with differential success of reproduction? That's called evolution by natural selection, Darwin 101. And that's what leads to fast adaptation of coronaviruses because they are single-stranded RNA viruses.
And zoonotic viruses can often live within their animal hosts without causing any harm, but it is when they spill over into an amplifier host, an animal amplifier host, and or humans that they manifest as diseases. Why is this?
It's because the virus gets a new opportunity in a new environment. If it's lucky and if it's adaptable, it can find that it can replicate abundantly in that new environment, that new host. And if it evolves further, it can even transmit from one individual of that new host to another. Maybe the old host has an immune system that has adapted to that virus over time, and that virus has adapted to the immune system so that in the old host, the reservoir host, it lives chronically at low levels of replication, but over long periods of time. And that is that's a type of genetic strategy, not a conscious strategy, but it is a strategy and it works. The virus maintains itself in the host population over long stretches of time, the reservoir host population. But then suddenly it gets a new kind of opportunity, a new kind of host, and it finds that it can replicate abundantly in this new host. And hey, look, with a few more adaptations, few more mutations, a little bit more natural selection, it can jump from this new reservoir host individual number one into individual number two, number three, number four. And if it does that, it is seizing an opportunity. It doesn't have purpose. It just has the ability to seize opportunity. If the new host is Homo sapiens, if it's us humans, then that virus has seized a huge opportunity for vast evolutionary success because it can replicate quickly, spread from individual to individual, ride on airplanes, get around the planet in 24 hours, spread to more people, and become possibly the most successful and abundant virus in the world. And that's what happens with pandemics. That's what happens with the pandemic flu. That's what seems to be happening with this. And that's what happened with the primary virus that causes the AIDS pandemic, a virus called HIV 1 group M that results from a single spillover from one chimpanzee into one human in the southeastern corner of Cameroon back in 1908, give or take a margin of error. All of this is known from good molecular work, and I'm jumping around here, but it's worth following this through. That virus infecting one human from one chimpanzee has spread around the world now and killed 33 million people, going on 34, and infected millions more. That's a very successful virus.
And you've talked about how human beings, as a relatively young species, are more susceptible. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Well, we are more susceptible because these viruses are new to us. As I say in the book, everything comes from somewhere. Our viruses that cause our infectious diseases generally come from animals because in the relatively short term, because we are a relatively young species. There are a few viruses that have been in humans for so long that they have evolved away from their origins and they are now distinct from whatever animal virus they originally descended from. Smallpox is one example, and polio is another example. And it's no coincidence that those are two of only very few severe infectious diseases that we have been able to eradicate or very nearly eradicate from humans. We've eradicated smallpox from humans. There are no current smallpox cases on the planet. It's not circulating. Smallpox virus only exists frozen in a few laboratories. And the last I've heard, we have nearly eradicated polio from the human population, but there are few places like Afghanistan, I think possibly Nigeria, but there are few places where there are difficult political and military situations where there are still little flare-ups of polio and it hasn't been eradicated yet. But almost, why can we do that? Well, because there is no animal host for polio or for smallpox anymore. Those are purely human viruses now.
And in Spillover, you write about how zoonotic diseases exist within and are part of a broader ecosystem.
So the spillover of these diseases into humans and the spread into pandemics, it's an ecological and evolutionary process. That's actually one of the reasons why I wrote Spillover. I'm very interested. It's my usual beat, ecology and evolutionary biology. I got interested in infectious diseases, emerging viruses like Ebola, and then I found, lo and behold, this is all about ecology and evolutionary biology. So on the ecology side, there are many, many diverse species of animal, plant, bacteria, fungi, and other creatures living in our diverse ecosystems. Each of those carries viruses. Each of those may carry its own unique viruses. Scientists are just trying to find out how many viruses are out there. When we humans come in contact with those animals and plants and other creatures, we expose ourselves to those viruses. In particular, when we come in contact disruptively, when we go into those diverse ecosystems, those tropical forests and those savannas where there is great diversity, and we start killing animals for meat, we start cutting down trees for timber, we build timber camps, we build mining camps, we harvest the wild animals further to feed the laborers in the timber camps and the mining camps, or we capture the wild animals and ship them away live or dead to be consumed by other people elsewhere. Doing all that, we disrupt those wild ecosystems. We essentially, this is sort of a metaphor, but we shake those viruses loose from their natural hosts and give them the opportunity to seize on a new host. And there we are, humans. And in some cases, then those viruses seize a new ecological situation, a new environment, namely a human body. And then comes evolution. And if they have a high intrinsic capacity for evolution, then they are all the more likely to adapt to us and become our diseases and sometimes our epidemics and pandemics.
Yeah, I think you said a virus is interconnected with other organisms at the scale of landscapes. And that really struck me because it forces us to think about a virus not just contained within a creature, say bats, which seems to be the culprit here in the coronavirus, but in relationship to a much broader web of life.
Right. Yes. I mean, they are ecological creatures with niches and with the capacity to evolve. And generally, they have their natural environments. But all of those creatures are connected to one another in intricate webs of interaction. We humans are part of those ecosystems too. I mean, anciently we have been. I'm not saying that these wild ecosystems have been wilderness in the sense that we used to think about it, you know, the absence of humans. All of these places, or almost all of them, have had human populations too, but living with very low impact, at very low population densities, living to some extent in harmony with the rest of the ecosystem, living off of it, harvesting animals and plants for food or for medicine, but not causing great disruption, and living in small groups of people that are not closely interconnected with big groups of people elsewhere. So what has changed in the modern world is that there are more of us, more interconnected, causing more disruption. Everything has been scaled up. Now we're the most dominant animal on the planet, arrogating to ourselves a huge proportion of all the resources, all the energy, all the protein, and making ourselves important and strong, but also making ourselves a huge target for these creatures that need habitat, that need environments, that need ecological niches in which to continue living.
And zoonotic viruses have been around for a very long time, as you've said, but in the last 50 years, we've really seen an emergence of many, many more in a short amount of time.
Right, right. And as I say in my book, there's been a drumbeat of these new emergences of viruses from animals that infect humans. Mapucho in Bolivia, 1962, coming out of rodents. Marburg in 1967 in monkeys that were shipped from Uganda to Marburg, Germany for use in medical labs. Ebola emerging for the first time we know of in 1976. AIDS, HIV getting recognized for the first time in 1981. You know, it goes on. In the late 1980s, there was something. In the early 90s, 1992, we became aware of hantavirus coming out of rodents in the Southwest, the Four Corners area of the U.S. Bird flu emerging in Hong Kong in 1997. 1998, it was Nipah virus in Malaysia coming out of bats, getting into pigs, and then getting into people, killing people. On and on. SARS, 2003. Also coming out of a bat. MERS, 2012, another coronavirus in the Arabian Peninsula, coming out of bats, getting into camels, going from camels to humans. Zika virus, another new one, 2014, on and on. And now here we are with COVID-19 in 2020.
In the last few weeks, with all the news about the coronavirus, you know, swamping everybody's world, there haven't necessarily been a discussion that looks to any of these root causes that you're describing, and that, you know, we are the victim here rather than playing an active part.
Right. There hasn't been enough discussion of that. People are alarmed. People are scared. People are angry at one another. Some people are angry at the Chinese. Other people are angry at, you know, public health services. We're all angry at Donald Trump. And there's not enough time, there's not enough bandwidth or air in the room for discussion of root causes. Yes, we need to flatten this curve. We need to deal with this pandemic. We need to take the public health measures that will bring this thing under control. And that's some ways off still. We need resources. We need money. We need will to do all the things that are necessary. And I hope we will. I think we will eventually get this thing under control and put this fire out. But as I've said before, when we get this thing under control, when we get the fire put out, we should celebrate for 5 minutes, and then we should start thinking about and planning for the next one, because there will be a next one.
That's right. Your op-ed in the Times back in January. In that piece, you outlined a list of all the long-term challenges we're dealing with that, in a sense, were many of the major ecological issues of our time, as well as issues related to poverty and inequality. So as much as this virus may wake people up to our interconnectedness and vulnerability, it seems like it's a monumental challenge that we're facing to address a potential next big one that might come up in a few years, or, you know, continue to come up year after year.
Right. It is a monumental challenge. And there are things on the scientific and the public health side that I listed, I guess, in that op-ed, and that one can list. Better viral discovery, so we know what's out there and might come into us. Better diagnostics, so that we can produce test kits very quickly. Better public health reactions, more resources, more excess capacity for our hospitals, et cetera, that prepares us to respond to these things. Coherent, internationally collaborative plans for to what extent you want to cut down air travel and to what extent you want to continue to let expertise flow between one country and another, all of that. But even beyond that, which is very expensive and will require really taking this kind of threat seriously, all of that is essentially reaction. And there needs to be proaction too. And that's even more difficult because it involves essentially reimagining, rethinking, and refeeling our relationship with the natural world. All of the things that we do that cause the disruption, that shakes loose these viruses, that gives them the opportunity to get into us, that all the draw that we put on resources around the world. And it's not just Chinese people who want to eat bats or pangolins. We can't just demonize them. There's enough responsibility to go around. Anybody that has a cell phone or a laptop is a customer for minerals such as coltan, which is essential for making tantalum capacitors in computers and cell phones. Where does coltan come from? Well, one of the major sources is in the southeastern corner of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where there are mining camps dragging coltan out of the earth, laborers working there adjacent to rich tropical forests that contain eastern lowland gorillas and all kinds of species of bats and other creatures. So if we buy a cell phone, we're purchasing coltan, and therefore we are drawing tighter this web of disruption. We are pulling viruses toward ourselves. We're part of that intricate web of responsibility. And therefore, we need to think about all of our consumer choices, all the choices we make, you know, what we buy, what we eat, how much we travel, how many children we have, all of those things. We need to be thinking deeply about them, not just for getting a control over climate change, which is the other huge problem looming there, but also dealing with this problem of zoonotic diseases and bringing all of these things closer to ourselves by our patterns of dominance and consumption.
In the book, you say that zoonotic diseases remind us, as St. Francis did, that we humans are inseparable from the natural world. In fact, there is no natural world. It's a bad and artificial phrase. There is only the world. Humankind is part of the world, as are all the viruses and carriers, which seems like there's a tremendous opportunity to think about how we can transition out of this outbreak as a human population to a space that lives in harmony. So I'm really curious to hear, you know, your feeling about that. How optimistic are you?
There is an opportunity. I'm not an optimist by disposition, but I'm stubborn when it comes to hope. I think that hope is not a psychological condition. Hope is an act of will. And therefore, I think we have a responsibility to be hopeful that we can do things that will make the final result at least not quite as bad as it might have been otherwise. And with this thing, this hideous pandemic that we're in right now, the scary thing that may take many, many lives, but in the meantime is also destroying people's jobs and disrupting cultures and economies around the world, it's a bad thing. The former mayor of Chicago, that guy named Rahm Emanuel, he famously said, we should let no crisis go to waste. And there's wisdom in that, and I think that's the case here. We should not let this crisis go to waste. We should use it as an opportunity to demand from ourselves and demand from our leaders substantive change, real drastic change in the way we live on this planet while we still have time.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Emmanuel. It's good to talk with you.
That was the executive editor of Emergence Magazine, Emmanuel Vaughn Lee, signing off from his conversation with science writer David Quammen. I heard this interview first on the podcast of Emergence Magazine on March 25, 2020, and was so moved and inspired by the exchange that I asked if I may rebroadcast excerpts. Thanks to editor Emmanuel Vaughn Lee for granting permission. You can find more information on the websites of emergencemagazine.org and on The Extraordinary Life, articles and books by David Quammen on his site, davidquammen.com. Quammen is spelled Quammen. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.